My 2024 Postcard from the USA, published on Sunday, the 12th of May, 2024. In late April, I made a trip to the United States of America. The trip encompassed a road trip with my family through Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama, my annual pilgrimage to the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting in Omaha, and several one-day visits to cities along the East Coast. The purpose of this postcard is to reflect on what I saw in the places I visited and heard from the people I met. Is there anything to write? I wrote a postcard after my recent trip to China. I felt inspired to do so, as so little information about China seems to filter into the consciousness of citizens in the West, beyond, of course, geopolitical spats and natural catastrophes. As such, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit for people like me to write about. The same is definitely not true for the US. There is likely no country in the world that is better understood outside its own borders than the US, thanks to its cultural exports and the ubiquity of the English language, amongst other things. I joked with a friend that I would not write a postcard from the US, as it would be an exercise in stating the obvious. Stop the press! The US is blanketed with Starbucks. I changed my mind as, yes, much is obvious, but what is obvious is easily overlooked or taken for granted, so worth occasionally restating. Also, not everything is obvious, at least from a European perspective. This brings me to my first and likely most obvious point. The ubiquity of American culture and values, what might be thought of as soft power, is one of the United States' superpowers. Vastness. What strikes you when you do a road trip in the US is the sheer size of the place. In the first week, we started in Atlanta and passed through Chattanooga, Nashville, Memphis, and Birmingham before returning to Atlanta. The entire trip was around 900 miles, all measurements in the imperial system out of deference to my hosts. Tennessee alone has four unique climate divisions, ranging from the lowlands of the Mississippi Valley to the mountain peaks in the east. And yet, the trip covered just a small fraction of the country's geographic area. See Google Map. If you are willing to clock an equivalent mileage in Europe, you could cross Western Europe, starting in Venice, enjoying a bowl of pasta in Milan, traversing the Alps, sipping a glass of Burgundy in Beaune, passing by Europe's second city, Paris, before ending up at the pinnacle of European, and most likely all culture, London. Disclaimer, I'm a Brit. The sheer scale of the United States is one of its superpowers. Homogeneity. Despite its vastness, it never ceases to amaze me how homogeneous the US is. One city or part of a city is often indistinguishable from another in terms of the shops and restaurants there. From an investment perspective, it quickly becomes clear as you travel around why so many companies can become so big so quickly. The cookie cutter works well in the US. Homogeneity extends to values. Paramount amongst these is patriotism. As you drive through the smaller towns, it is rare to see a home that does not have a flagpole sporting the Star-Spangled Banner, some of which are of truly extraordinary girth. As my South African friends would say, they are serious flags. Shared values are one of the United States' superpowers. Freedom. The value you hear most about in the US is individual freedom. The ability to say and do what you want within the confines of the law is so obvious that it is easily taken for granted. This point was brought home to me when I met a friend at Off the Record, a bar in Washington, D.C., a few hundred meters from the White House. It has the vibe of a speakeasy and is the kind of place you can imagine Bob Woodward meeting with Deep Throat. It is where the coasters hail from on the cover of this postcard. As the male of the human species is prone to do when it gathers with a fellow male over a beer, we complained about the dreadfulness of our political leaders in general and in the US in particular. Take a step back though, and it is pretty remarkable that you can voice such opinions increasingly loudly as the beer kicks in, just a few hundred meters from the epicenter of power, and think nothing of it. I'm not sure how many other places in the world outside of Europe where this would be possible without fear of the consequences. The sentiment amongst many people I met is that this freedom is increasingly under attack. A bus driver I met, more about him later, complained that only the homeless are truly free, and politely inquired whether we also have to pay taxes in Switzerland. We do. His opinion likely does not represent a mainstream view, but the sentiment underlying it likely does. People told me of their fear of being cancelled for stating an unpopular view. Left-leaning people are terrified of being cancelled by MAGA, and right-leaning people are terrified of being cancelled by the wokerati. This is a worrying trend, but compared with most countries, the US strikes me as pretty free still. Another topic that cropped up in the context of free speech was TikTok. The US has ordered TikTok to be sold, or else it will be banned in the US. While some, including the Chinese government, view this as an attack on free speech, I am with the US here. Social networks have enormous power to influence people by either promoting content they like or suppressing content they don't. Understandably, the US does not want this power in the hands of a foreign company that is beholden to the Chinese government. Furthermore, if the CCP is so concerned about free speech, it could simply allow ByteDance to sell TikTok to a Western owner, and more importantly, allow foreign social networks to operate in China. The freedom to say and think what you want is one of those United States superpowers. Homelessness. The most upsetting element of the trip was seeing large numbers of homeless people in every city we visited. As bad as homelessness is, though, what makes it worse is the parlous state that many homeless people find themselves in. Many seem unable to take care of themselves due to mental health issues, drug issues, or a combination of the two. India has far more homeless people than the US, and yet I have rarely seen anyone there in as bad a shape as the average homeless person in the US. My bus driver friend's envy was misplaced, as he would for sure not want to swap places with them. The problem of homelessness makes visiting a US city far less enjoyable than it might otherwise be. It is difficult to enjoy the food in the restaurant or the warmth of a hotel bed if you know someone else is going hungry or sleeping rough. This is not a plea to get the homeless out of tourist areas, but to help them. I can recall in my teenage years that London had a similar problem with homelessness. While it is by no means solved today, it has improved considerably. Cardboard city under Waterloo Bridge is no longer a thing. The blight of homelessness can be solved, and it is incumbent on a country as wealthy as the United States to do so. A belief in freedom for the individual should not mean a lack of responsibility for the collective good of all citizens. Neglect for society's weakest members is certainly not one of the United States' superpowers. Immigration. At every company I visited, either as an investor or simply as a customer, I met people from different countries and cultures. Every city has restaurants serving every imaginable type of food from around the world. We enjoyed Mexican, Japanese, Indian, Greek, and Italian, to name but a few. Not to mention many, too many hamburgers. In case you were wondering, Shake Shack remains my go-to, though I prefer the fries from Five Guys. Openness to people of different nationalities is one of the US's great strengths. Sadly, the window of opportunity to legally migrate to the US is increasingly closing. I heard at several companies that foreign employees with unique skills are finding it increasingly difficult to either extend visas or get them in the first place. This is an unbelievable unowned goal when you consider how many of the US's great companies have been started by migrants or are led by one today. Lower skilled workers are valuable too. The last time I looked, the indigenous population had no desire to do the basic and often unpleasant jobs that migrants are only too delighted to do to get their shot at the American dream. It is depressing to think that immigration will likely play such a central role in the forthcoming election. Nevertheless, the US remains the most culturally diverse place on the planet. The welcome afforded to people of different countries is one of the United States' superpowers. Israel. The topic of Israel cropped up several times during my trip, especially during the East Coast leg, where I visited several university endowment clients. I did not make it myself onto any of the university campuses, but I heard from several of the endowments that they have at times looked more akin to war zones than places of study. Perhaps it was for the best that I did not put in an appearance, as I learnt on the trip that RV Capital is likely a persona non grata. Some of the protesters are demanding that their endowments divest their Israeli investments. As you know, RV holds one Israeli investment, the website builder Wix. In case you were wondering, the feedback I received from all the endowments was to continue to invest their capital where the chances of supporting their long-term mission are highest, as it should be. They are unbowed by the protesters, and so is RV Capital. Strictly speaking, this is a postcard from the US, but I have twice traveled to Israel and would like to share just one brief observation. Israel is a very, very small country in a vast continent. See the Google Maps screenshot below. I had to remove my safe places as otherwise the staff from my favorite coffee shop in Tel Aviv covered the entire country and then some. It's Nahat, in case you were wondering. You cannot see Israel on the map below, but it is between Egypt and Syria. You likely already knew Israel is small, in the same way that you knew the US is vast, but there is no substitute for going there to feel it viscerally. When I first landed at Tel Aviv International Airport and took the short taxi ride into the city, I felt a pang of disappointment that I would not get to go to Jerusalem. I needn't have. A short taxi ride in the opposite direction would have got me there. By then, I would have driven from one side of the country to the other. Both Europe and the Middle East used to have large and prosperous Jewish populations. Thanks to millennia of pogroms culminating in the Holocaust, Israel is the only remaining enclave with a significant Jewish population. And, to repeat myself, it is a tiny spot in a vast and sadly hostile continent. This does not mean that the country should get an automatic pass when it screws up. Like everyone, its leaders do not always get things right. And like everywhere, it also does not always have the leaders it would wish for. However, I do believe that if ever there was a country that would want to err on the side of safety when protecting itself, it is Israel, given its geography and its history. To its enormous credit, the US broadly seems to get this. I'm not sure that Europe does, except perhaps for Germany. The US is supportive of both Israel and its Jewish population. In every city I went to in the US, I saw Jewish families wandering around wearing Orthodox clothing. This sight is largely absent in most European cities, though not in my home city of Zurich. Religious tolerance is one of the United States' superpowers. The impending election. Towards the end of my trip, I passed through Washington, D.C. With the U.S. election just 5 months away, the question of who will be the next president was looming large, not just in the nation's capital, but everywhere, not least in Europe. I asked nearly everyone I met who they thought would win. Businesses are well advised not to be political, so I will choose my words carefully. The candidate that you hope will lose may well not lose. Phew. I think I dodged that bullet. The president in the US is chosen by the Electoral College. Each state allocates all of its votes to a single candidate. As most states are firmly in the Democratic or Republican camps, it will come down to a handful of states in the South and the Midwest. Whether a few thousand people in a handful of swing states decide to vote on the 5th of November may determine who the next president is. It is too close to call, and anyone who claims otherwise is deluding themselves. You heard it here first. We have another 4 years of either Trump or Biden ahead of us. Neither candidate is likely to be a superhero. The power of philanthropy. Of all the cities I visited, the one I liked most, and by some distance, was Omaha. It has beautiful public spaces along the Missouri River, including an urban beach, an amphitheater, and some epic slides for kids. See image. It also has a world-class zoo, though I did not make it. Downtown is beautifully preserved and feels like the set of a Western movie. Much of this and more is the result of the philanthropy of the city's citizens, many of whose wealth can be traced directly to being shareholders in Berkshire Hathaway. The rule of thumb is if you've been invested for 50 years, you're a billionaire, and if you've been invested for 40 years, you're a centimillionaire. Hey, not everyone can be born on the right side of the tracks. It is a testament to the power of community and philanthropy the generosity of Americans, and above all, to Warren Buffett and his late partner, Charlie Munger. I may well be the first person to make this connection, but in terms of its beautiful public spaces and livability, Omaha reminds me of the finest Asian cities such as Singapore and Shanghai. It is far smaller, but the area around the river is as impressive. The wealth that the US economy generates and the willingness of its citizens to give it away to those needier than themselves give me some optimism that enduring social problems such as homelessness may be solved over time. Philanthropy is definitely one of the United States' superpowers. The Berkshire Hathaway Shareholder Meeting. After the Berkshire Hathaway Shareholder Meeting, I generally share my thoughts on what I learned with the folks I meet on the road. The good people of the US have suffered, so why shouldn't you? This year's meeting was poignant, as it was the first without Warren Buffett's longtime partner, Charlie Munger. I had the enormous privilege of having dinner with Charlie in 2019 and loved him. See image. Despite this, I was not too upset by his passing. I cannot imagine a life more fully lived. As we say in the UK, he had a good innings. However, when a video of history's greatest partnerships was played at the meeting, I found myself sobbing uncontrollably. It was a cathartic experience. Charlie's absence also created space for Warren's successors, Greg Abel and Ajit Jain, to take a more prominent role in the meeting, a development I enjoyed enormously. Ajit is responsible for Berkshire's insurance activities, whilst Greg is responsible for the other operating businesses. Of these, the railroad and the utility are the largest contributor to earnings. Berkshire's stock has done well in recent years, thanks largely to Buffett's prescient purchase of Apple. Will this guy ever stop slugging the ball out of the park? The development of the operating businesses, though, has been disappointing. A challenge for all three is regulation. Where regulation is so onerous that Berkshire's assets can no longer produce an economic return, it is tantamount to expropriation. Buffett, Jane, and Abel pointed to the enormous need for investment in power generation, think AI, and catastrophe insurance, think climate change. They underlined that Berkshire will only make the investments necessary if they are allowed to make an economic return. Allowing businesses to serve customers and make money is fundamental to capitalism, and they all expect regulators to come to their senses. Robust ownership rights have served the American economy well. Society and the regulators that represent it would do well not to forget it. The respect for ownership rights is one of the United States' superpowers. Work ethic. I visited several companies on my trip, some of which we are invested in, some of which we may be one day. I asked them all whether employees were finally coming back to the office. The answer I heard most frequently is that they increasingly are, but it tends to be only on Tuesdays to Thursdays. I have no idea what the right balance between working from home and working from the office is, but it does strike me as suspicious that employees work from home on the 2 days of the week either side of the weekend. Is Tuesday the new Monday? And is Thursday the new Friday? I could not help but contrast it with my recent visit to China. There, the debate is around the culture of 996, i.e. working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. Regarding work ethic, I heard a story in the US about a German company, but it is too delicious to leave out of this postcard. A friend of mine interviewed 30 candidates to fill the role of an apprentice at his company. Of the 30, only two brought the qualities he was looking for. Of those, one took an offer from elsewhere, and the other said he was only willing to work 1 day a week, as he did not want to neglect his hobbies and social life. I was shocked that someone would have so little ambition so early in their career. I also wondered how someone could finance their lifestyle by working only 1 day a week on an entry-level salary. Oh no, my friend replied. He was expecting a full salary. I assume, stroke hope, that this story is not typical. But the point remains that there is a gulf between the work ethic of Chinese and Western workers. There may be a cyclical element to this. There is zero unemployment in the West, whilst at the same time there is a recession in China. Nevertheless, I suspect a decent portion of it is structural. This is a problem. No matter how good you are, if your opponent is training 6 days a week and you are only training 3 days a week, you're going to get your ass kicked. the three-day work week is not one of the United States' superpowers. Guns. One of the things most puzzling to Europeans is the American fascination with guns. I had two experiences that helped me understand the phenomenon slightly better. The first was a chat with my bus driver friend. I know, you're not supposed to use buses in the US, but it is in the European genes. And in any case, what would this postcard have amounted to if I had not met this road warrior philosopher? Without any prompting, he started telling me about an antique Magnum handgun he had owned that, though impractical, was a thing of beauty. He then went on to tell me that he has more modern weapons for the primary purpose of protecting his grandchildren, and finished up by complaining about how expensive it is to rent a firing range for a day for recreational shooting. If Maslow's hierarchy of needs ranges from the most basic to the most advanced, it strikes me that shooting covered pretty much all the bases for him. Persuading him to part with his guns would be the equivalent of asking me to part ways with my home, soccer, and reading. Good luck with that. The second is the near ubiquity in the South of signs on the doors of shops and restaurants requesting that customers not bring guns in. The sign is both exotic and absurd in European eyes. Exotic, as we do not see them back home, and absurd, as surely the type of person that respects the sign is exactly the kind of person you'd want to bring their gun in. It's a catch-22. The insurance business has the concept of negative selection, meaning that the people most likely to require insurance purchase the product. That sign has a negative selection problem. It encapsulates the dilemma US policymakers face when trying to formulate more sensible gun laws. That aside, it is unconscionable that more is not done to prevent mass shootings, in particular in schools. When foreign terrorists committed the 9/11 atrocities, the US, quite correctly, spared no expense to try and prevent a repeat, including spending over $1 trillion in Iraq, for which, of course, the Iraqi people will no doubt be eternally grateful. The US should work to prevent domestic terrorists with similar vigor. Gun laws are not one of the United States' superpowers. Kindness. It is impossible to write about a trip to the US without mentioning how kind the people generally are. One example sticks in my mind, though there were many. As we were walking down Broad Street in Chattanooga one morning, a gentleman stopped us to point out that the town has a free bus service. Whilst waiting for the bus, he told us that the local baseball team, the Lookouts, were playing home that evening. Thanks to him, we had an enjoyable day visiting Chattanooga's high points, including the Chattanooga Choo Choo, had a fun evening at the ballpark, and met the US's finest bus driver, philosopher. Kindness is one of the United States' superpowers. Tipping. If the people are the highlight of a trip to the US, a good candidate for the lowlight is the tipping culture. It is simply out of control. I understand that at restaurants, the waiting staff are dependent upon tips as they do not receive much in the way of salary otherwise. However, every shop seemed to be looking for a tip this time, including those without any service component whatsoever. I saw a meme of a self-service gas pump asking for a tip. I think it is a joke. But then again, this insanity has to end. Tipping culture is not one of the United States' superpowers. China. China came up in nearly all my conversations in the US. I suspect that this is partly because I'd written a memo on the topic shortly before the trip, partly because I presented a Chinese company, PDD, as my stock idea at an investor meeting in Omaha, and partly because everyone is intrigued by the bargain basement valuations of Chinese stocks, but terrified by the geopolitical risks. What struck me from most of these conversations is how badly China's strengths and weaknesses are understood in the West. When I wear my investor hat, it is great to see how poorly understood the subject matter is. However, as a citizen of Switzerland, Europe, and the West, I am deeply concerned that China's strengths, and more importantly, its weaknesses, are so poorly understood. There are areas where we cooperate with China, and there are areas where we compete. In the latter, we are going to get our asses kicked if we do not understand our opponent. When I presented the case for PDD and discussed China more generally, the pushbacks that I heard included product quality, rampant fraud, the use of child labor, the use of slave labor, tax avoidance, unfair subsidies, and a quasi-communist system. These are all frankly absurd. I write this not to talk my own investment book, but because if Western companies are to compete effectively with Chinese ones, they need to understand the challenge they face. Chinese companies are perfectly able to produce high-quality goods if that is what the market desires, as multiple companies have demonstrated. BYD is one example amongst many. China has plenty of real businesses, despite innuendo to the contrary, such as this FT article about PDD. See link. The author asked rhetorically where the factories are if Temu is such a big business, and yet, according to Reuters, Shein and Temu export nearly 600,000 packages to the US every single day. Thanks to the one-child policy, kids in China work long days, but in school, not in factories, as parents focus all their ambition on their sole child. The destitute family I described in my recent postcard that plow all their excess savings into their sole child's education illustrate this point well. Modern companies require educated and motivated employees to succeed. Leaving aside moral considerations, there would be no benefit from having forced labor. Slave labor would be no more beneficial to a Chinese company than it would to an American one, such as Google or General Motors. PDD does not pay duty on imports in many countries as its packages fall under the so-called de minimis threshold. However, it can only operate according to the rules as they are. Even if it wanted to pay duty, the infrastructure is not in place to assess so many packages, though it likely will be one day. It will not matter, though, as its cost advantage lies in how it has re-engineered the supply chain using the C2M model, or consumer to manufacturer, which I describe in my most recent investor letter, not in tax arbitrage. Chinese companies benefit from subsidies, but so do companies in the West. They are one tool in the policy toolbox and likely the least effective one. Most Western countries have subsidized electric cars, as has China. And all Western OEMs are flush with cash today. If access to capital was the decisive factor, they would be in pole position. Finally, China may nominally be communist, but I sense that the power of capitalism and its foundation in property rights is understood more viscerally there than in the West. Memories in China are still fresh of the misery caused by the Cultural Revolution. I am less sure that this is so viscerally understood in the West, where, thankfully, we have had it so good for so long, though the legal protection of property rights is no doubt stronger here. Berkshire Hathaway's travails with regulators are a case in point. In summary, China has many strengths, not least the maniacal focus on education, the work ethic of its people, innovation, a highly functioning capitalist economy, and a sense of collective responsibility. It also has its weaknesses, though, an overbearing government, a low-trust society, a lack of racial diversity and immigration, undisciplined capital allocation, a lopsided, though intense, education system, and above all, a lack of individual freedom. A superpower with superpowers. The US has weaknesses too, some of which I touched on in this memo. Declining tolerance for dissenting views, overbearing regulation, a deteriorating work ethic, a lack of support for society's weakest members, and, how shall I put this, somewhat aged, challenged leaders. More importantly, though, it has multiple superpowers. It has soft power, scale, immigrants, shared values, freedom of expression, philanthropy, property rights, and Warren Buffett. The United States is a superpower with superpowers, but it needs to lean further into its superpowers, not away from them. Thanks for reading and happy investing. Oh, and PS, if you would like to give a small tip to cover the cost of the postage stamp on this postcard, you may do so by following the link in the show notes. Thanks and bye.